He's then going to introduce this group of astounding individuals. I look at them and I think to myself, these are people that I've known for years who have been part of the last 20 years in the association with big, big efforts. So, Pauline, it's all
thanks.
Yours.
Thank you, Kieran. Kia ora katoa. I'm just going to briefly introduce the panel members and then it's over to them. Beside me, we have John Dunlop, who has experience in almost every aspect of social work, from NGOs to government, private practice, consultancy, supervision, managing the competency program, and overseas experience. So John will be very interesting to discuss his thoughts and experiences over this period. And then we have Bella Wikaira, who has and is working in women's health within the district health boards in Auckland and NGOs currently, is in her fourth term as a member of the board and is involved with the Tangata Whenua Caucus. Then we have David McNabb, who is currently an educator, has worked for the Department of Social Welfare and also in mental health and general health. And Howard Randall, down the end, who has a lot of experience, is in all sorts of areas, as an educator, as the executive officer of the ANZASW, and what else? Involved in the competency program at the beginning, which is great. So I'll hand over to you people.
Thank you. Thank you. Just to set the scene for this period, the previous group of people talked about the significance of working from a bicultural perspective. We'll be able to add to that a little bit. They talked about the commitment to standards of practice, codes of ethics and competency. We want to have a wee bit of a chat about that. And then we're going to talk about how the association has moved and grown. So there's some themes. But I think the period of time, which is interesting, this is when the association at some level grew up, because we moved from having Liz Beddoe's front table as the office to a brief sojourn while we were in Wellington, and then Howard and the National Executive moved the entire office of the association as checked baggage down from Wellington to Dunedin to establish the Dunedin office. It's also a period of time when the association grew quite largely and quite quickly. We had, as you heard during the discussions over the last couple of days, a membership down to about 300 just before this. At this period of time in this decade, we started at about 700 members and we ended up with about 2,000. So it's a 300% increase during that 10 years. Largely attributable to the fact that we had set that mark in the sand around professionalism, around competency. And competency was a double-edged sword. It was one of those things that brought people into the association. It allowed people like me to join, because I had distanced myself from the association in the 70s because of that debate around if you were qualified, you could become a member. If you were not qualified, you couldn't. I fortunately was qualified, I could have, but I had actually worked in the NGO sector, in the community sector, and believed that the work that was being done by those people was such that they would not be able to be full members. And so I distanced myself until competency became the driver and the way that you could actually achieve membership. That's an interesting thing for us to reflect on when we're still talking about expanded membership. Yep, sure. So I invite you to really do some thinking about that. So what we wanted to look at in terms of themes was the sort of growth of the membership and the infrastructure, the influence of the Tangata Whenua and the Rōpū development around the country, the notion of succession planning around how do we actually continue to grow and how do we actually have a national executive that changes and reinvigorates and such. It was the growth of the time that we became involved in international social work a lot more. And a commitment to registration and moving towards registration. And of course, a number of the members who are in this room and had their photographs we tried to get everybody in the room to get one photograph taken. A large number of the association, six of us, became members of the registration board when it was first established. So that commitment for registration occurred. So I would like you to have all been able to sit with us for breakfast this morning, because we sat at breakfast time around a table to have the conversation about the conversation we want to have now. And it would have been better to have actually taped that conversation than to actually have the anxiety about sitting here and having the conversation now. But we don't intend to have a set spiel. We intend to talk to each other about things that have actually occurred and to interject amongst each other and invite conversations around from the floor around things that you might want to know about the theme that we might be currently talking about. So Bella's going to kick us off because she's going to talk about that sort of the influence of Tangata Whenua because of the decisions made just a little bit beforehand in the last decade around a commitment to work much more strongly and much more committed in terms of a bicultural way. So the Rōpū development around the country and the involvement of Tangata Whenua and the association. And we'll add to that, subtract from it, whatever.
Kia ora, John. Kia ora tātou. My introduction to the association came in 95 when I joined as a fairly new practitioner in women's health. And in 96 is when the Tangata Whenua stream really kicked off for me, at least. And that was when the likes of Nora Merle, who was on the National Council, sent out a pānui to Māori social workers. Didn't have to be members of the association at that time. And I remember she sent an envelope with the membership, Tangata Whenua membership at that time. And there was about 77, I counted. And when I was looking through, it was interesting to see the front sheets when you identify your iwi affiliations. Some had put in Ngāti Pākehā, we had Cook Island Māori, and so the numbers of Tangata Whenua that were actually members was a little bit less. But at that hui that was called by Nora Merle, we had her and Tudor, who was in the vice president's position at the time, and he was keeping the seat warm for Tangata Whenua to sit there as some of the foundations had been set out prior to that hui. And it was a real landmark for me as far as it generated some kōrero talking about things that happened in Tūranga Waiwai in 86, and so 10 years later we were coming together again and saying, are we prepared to take this journey? And at that stage I think we all started on the journey with good intentions, and we had John Bradley facilitating that hui. And from that hui, it moved around the motu over to Tauranga Moana after that, and as I said, all over the motu. And it gained momentum. It started generating the development of Rōpū and regular contact, and hui happened from that point on. Looking at establishing policies and procedures, ensuring that Tangata Whenua met the bicultural commitment that we had made in terms of having Tangata Whenua on all of the committees that were established. And I remember it was really good to hear those discussions yesterday and just reminding me how far we've come. So I'll have a bit of a rest from this point.
The Rōpū are not all still operational, are they?
Not currently.
Yeah. So what needs to happen to sort of reinvigorate all of the branches in Rōpū, because some of them are not active around the country? What do you?
That's next yes, next decade, current issues. Kia ora Bella, kia ora koutou. Just to carry on the theme of partnership and bicultural journey within the association, it was my privilege to become involved in national executive in 95 here at the Asia in Christchurch at the Asia Pacific Conference. Some people might recall that massive conference. We had the international president visiting. In fact, IFSW executive were here. Really something quite special. And for me, as I moved into the president role in 96, we as an executive had the example of Buster Kirsten and Matua Turo Haronga as our model, as it were, of partnership and sharing on national executive amongst other national executive members. So it was my privilege to be partnering with Nora Merle Davis on national executive, and we, you know, were around, as Bella was saying, during this incredible growth of Rōpū and Tangata Whenua involvement in all the committees and infrastructure. As I mentioned last night, it was a great, you know, time of growth and representation, for example, on National Council. But trying to fit everyone around the table as we had all this representation, and then trying to fund it, that was a challenge. So we had to sort of keep reworking how our administration could keep up with or support our growth and our commitment and where we were heading. But it was a fabulous time, and I also remember in terms of expressing that bicultural commitment internationally, we were very committed during this period to fronting up Te Iwi Tangata Whenua at, you know, Asia Pacific events, Australia, etc. Certainly at the IFSW events from 1994 in Sri Lanka, which was the first international conference I went to, 96 in Hong Kong, 98 in Israel. That was interesting. Through to Montreal in 2000, etc. It was a great time, I think, of a real strength around Tangata Whenua and the partnership in our system.
Not for me. I guess meanwhile, nationally and administratively, the administration in Buster's latter part of his presidency was through Gaylene Lawrence, both in Palmerston North and then subsequently to Wellington. And as we call at the end of that decade, you know, the membership that we ended up with was pretty low. And it certainly grew within the next 10 years or so. So administratively, I think also what Buster bought was a more of a business plan approach too, because they'd been laid out the coming out of earlier councils and so forth had been laid out a forward thinking strategic direction, formal strategic direction for the association, which captured all that had gone before, and so there were certain streams that the council and the association was really deemed to follow. But I think with it returned to an effort to have a regional council formation, but I gather there were not enough funds for the first regional council to meet. So in terms of an association, you know, still having a voice, still having a place to meet, It was in dire straits, but it did subsequently have a regional council meeting in 1994, and the decision then was subsequently made to as I said to have the administrator in Gaylene Lawrence was in Wellington, and I picked up the national office in
96, 97.
And behind that was also the sort of drive for professionalisation was starting to come forward. People may recall that Child, Youth and Family made several significant attempts to professionalise its staff, and in 95 had a review by Coopers and Lybrand of its effort, and it was rather sad reading given the investment that that had been put into it at that time. So there were a number of things up in the air, which again depended on really getting membership going and beginning to address through the structure of the association the need to have established branches and established rupu. I think the intention was where there was a branch, there'd also be a rupu.
Mm. It was also the period of time when interest groups grew.
Yes.
So let's talk about the interest groups.
Yes. Just to mention, I was. It's great to have John Wong here at conference, and we think that it was the Chinese Social Workers Interest Group was one of the first interest groups, certainly of that nature, which I think was formally established in 2000 at the Auckland conference. I think I remember the National Council meeting there, and we were so impressed by this incredibly organised group that had their 10 members to form a body with an association, and people turned up. And I must admit, I'm not up with where that group is at the moment, but for many years they were active, very engaged, National Council, producing documents, a very vibrant network and quite exciting. Subsequently, Pacifica Interest Group was established, and of course we had the exciting development of the Tumo edition of the journal that came a little later as well. And then other interest groups, certainly around ethnic identity, African, Zimbabwe, etc., came later. So yes, it was a good time. Well, we've got a hand up here, Mr. Hi. Yeah.
I just, David, you prompted me. I just really wanted to mention at this point another life member who's not here, Dr. Dougal MacDonald, because he was instrumental in the Asia Pacific to get the conference to come to Christchurch. That was a huge conference. There was a huge groundswell and interest in for social workers to be part of that. It was probably one of the first opportunities people in New Zealand had to engage internationally with their colleagues from overseas. So I didn't want to let that opportunity pass in terms of acknowledging Dougal's work.
I thought we could remember Horiana Joyce, who was the kaiwhakahaere at that hui, and did a wonderful, wonderful job as, what do you call it, your, what's your role called? Coordinator. Yeah, she started every day with karakia and whakatauhi.
That's right.
It was, it made that hui based in Aotearoa in a very real way, and I so sad to lose Array so soon.
Some of the interest groups had quite specific focus. For example, the private practice interest group was fighting the fight with ACC around whether, in fact, social workers could undertake counselling functions for ACC and to ensure that counsellors were respected and paid a reasonable fee for undertaking their work. Mind you, we've always been at the bottom of that heap. But at the same time, things like we had to fight that same sort of fight with the family courts. I was involved in advocating for that as well. Things like the Psychologists Association were claiming grounds about being the preferred providers. I can remember going to the select committee talking about the care and treatment of adolescents who sexually offend and being told by the select committee, why don't psychologists and social workers talk together? Because the psychologists had just been in and said that they were the only credible providers of sex offender treatment in this country. And I was able to respond by saying they are a provider,
but in the area of community-based treatment of sex offenders, most of the programs throughout the country were established by social workers, but we wouldn't be arrogant enough to say it is social work, which is the preferred body of knowledge, to actually undertake that work. That good treatment-providing groups come from counsellors, family therapists, psychologists, and people who are committed to the course of work, as opposed to a particular clinical group that was saying that. So there was those kind of things that the interest groups were able to take on board and actually provide evidence and become parts of working groups and working parties around changes to legislation and things that occurred.
And as part of the formal structure too was the standing committees, the particular standing committees that were coming through, which was around course approvals, was around ethics and judicial, because that was needing its own procedures as well. And of course the Board of Competency was pretty well established by 1994, but it was growing, and of course there was the network of assessors to be maintained. Then, of course, that was 5 years into that, we had recertification. And so we had to produce new guidelines, which John was a part of with
Maurice McGregor,
to produce the guidelines for recertification as the first stream of people came through after 5 years to do the recertification. So there was quite a bit going on to honour what was said.
Just wanting to add on to Howard in terms of competency, and how during this decade the Niho Taniwha was developed, and then it was put into place, and some of our first competencies that we had in Tamaki Makaurau laid the foundations for the Rōpū assessors to deal with the backlog of tangata whenua social workers who are wanting to go through the Niho Taniwha process for competency, but we didn't have enough assessors to provide the service. So, it laid the foundations for us to think more laterally and looking at how we can meet the need with the structure that we have in place. And so, I think that went a long way towards building a close relationship between the Rōpū assessors, between the Rōpū, and giving us a stronger voice within the association at that time.
As someone who was had a couple of goes at being a national assessor during this period, it was exciting to see the development of the tangata whenua process, and at times that was separate, and at times it literally was a partnered process. I still remember, I think, I see Fitial down here. I think we had a combined process at the ACE College in the Marae there for one of the earlier versions of combined competency assessment and use of Niho Taniwha. But those of us on the Tawiwi side and Tangata Whenua together, Matua Turoa was there as well, I remember. But quite special of creating our own version of competency assessment with that bicultural base. Yeah.
Can I just acknowledge Turoa saying that we actually had our first three practice legal tenure by action at Barron's Quarry Hospital.
The grant system.
And we also we've made it as who we are by Harry Walker, who actually didn't believe that we should have it combined to the present. So that debate starts back then and continues to do that.
Begins to sound as if quite a bit of money was being spent, actually, when you think of the development of these committees, these groups. The council meetings were getting larger, and of course people were being funded to those, but at least what that did, it served the purpose of ensuring that there was a forum, quorum for the AGM. But there was one AGM in Wellington earlier on where we had a council meeting and we were anticipating that all the Wellington members would come along to the AGM and they didn't. And we didn't have an AGM, we couldn't have one because we didn't have 10 people to have a quorum. But nonetheless, it does beg the question, how did we begin to fund ourselves? Well, we were blessed with somebody who had a ganzt prattish approach. Who would have a ganzt prattish approach, if I've got my pronunciation? Not bad. We were blessed with a number of treasurers, of course, who looked after the finances. And the first was Gunther. And Gunther and Jean Pace, as she was then, but is now Jean Lawrence, came on to the national executive in Hamilton. And we had a new president in Robin.
Hamilton Harata.
Harata, who is in New Zealand presently. Harata went to Australia, but she's back in New Zealand for a few weeks, I gather. But we had a new president. We had Robin as vice president in Hamilton, and Gunther and Jean Lawrence, and we shifted the office to Dunedin. But a ganzt prattish approach is one where you find the most workable solution, and that was Gunther's approach as being the treasurer. And, you know, in those days, the treasurer held the checkbook and required two signatures. And we were trying to, when the office was first moved to Dunedin, my first task, and I was on my own at that point for 20, 30 hours a week, I think it was. And as you heard, we had a computer that died. But we had two databases, however. We had a financial database and we had a membership database. But it was difficult to work out the correlation between the two, because you had automatic payments coming in, which had to be reconciled every month against that person's membership, which was done financially. And then, of course, to keep up the pace with people who were doing competency and so forth. So it was interesting. And but with a national executive that was using all means to save costs. I mean, one example was a beaut, in that there'd be, say, eight or nine people we wanted to connect together for an executive meeting, maybe less than that. But we'd have three people who were on three-way calling. Okay, so instead of paying heaps of money to Telecom for a teleconference for 2 or 3 hours, we'd link up through three-way calling. So one person with three-way calling would call somebody else with three-way calling, who would call the other two people, who would call the other two people, and we could all get together. But if the link was broken, if somebody went away and dropped the phone or something, it was bedlam. But to help with that, of course, Gunther would bring a bottle of wine. So for us, for those of us that were in Dunedin, it was Jean and myself in particular, and Gunther, we were fine if there was a break. Because we had it was done from home and so forth. But that was the beginning of it. That was really a need to get hold of members coming in, because that's where we weren't getting any more money from Margaret Baisley, as I recall. But we had to ensure that we were able to respond to the resources that were required, but also to get the house in order so that it could manage that better. And that took some time. Whilst we had a software called Quantum Q5, I think, and of course we also. Introduced ourselves to the internet and we had email addresses, which was marvellous. But of course, that creates other things. So we had to have an IT specialist to make sure that that we got the best viruses and filters. Because in those days, the stuff that would come through the internet was not good. And so that had to be
which Howard had to personally check each item as to how bad it was before deleting. Yeah.
We moved, just to go on briefly, we moved into an office in what's known in Dunedin as Consultancy House, and it was the first skyscraper in New Zealand. It was built at the turn of the last century. And we were on the sixth floor, and it's a fabulous old building, which we were one of the first early tenants when it was being completely refurbished, and now it's a very smart again looking building. It used to house a stock exchange and things like that, and head offices of this, that, and everything else. But it was a great facility for us, and I'm talking about us then, because gradually, we were in a position to bring in Catherine Adamson as an administrative officer, administrative assistant, and then subsequently a financial officer. So we had somebody looking after the finances, which was Denise Curtin, and then with the with the growth of competency, we had Susan Marsh, who I think is probably still here. Yes, who came in particularly to look after the administration of competency, and so it was a good team. But all along we were very frugal. I can tell you. That's enough for that.
Yeah, I just realizing that one of the other significant things that occurred, because when we had that little brochure, Claim Your Identity, it was around the notion that one of the other things the association offered was indemnity insurance, and that protection for people should there be things that go wrong. And so Buster again was instrumental in getting Murray Rosser to be involved as that indemnity insurer. And just to let people realise how important and valuable that was, I undertook a contract with the Otago DHB in which I was going to get it wrong. There was an agency that was going to be closed down because of criticisms about their practice, and the agency itself was resisting that. And so they agreed that they would have an independent person look at how this agency operated and whether it would stay open or not. So his Nibs was invited to do this, and I said, look, I'm going to piss some people off somehow. You know, either the agency's going to have to close and they're going to get really angry and they might try and have a go at me in terms of the outcomes that I've actually identified, or alternatively, the family who are concerned about the way the practice is being delivered in this agency are going to have a go that this wasn't a professional report and it wasn't looking widely enough at the issues. So I said to the DHB, I require indemnity insurance for this period of time. And they agreed to add that to my contract, and I had to go out and purchase it individually. I purchased it for 1 year, and it was $580. That was the year that the association bought in its indemnity insurance, and as I recall, it was something like $54 or something. So that was the actual amount of money. It's kind of like 10 times, and I'd have had to pay that on an annual basis if there was not indemnity insurance for the association. So when we talked about claiming your identity and that being a real asset and something to hang on to, it's still there and it's still an asset to hang on to, and it's still something we should let people know, because your employer does not always stand behind you when you're being challenged and your practice is being challenged, and your indemnity insurance is something really valuable.
Can I just add another little item during this decade that I and some others were involved in, which came to be known as the Course Approval Board, which was the profession's attempt at having a voice and a say in the approval of social work programs. As we could see, there was the Social Work Training Council, NZSETAs, etc., and of course now the Registration Board gives a key approval for programs. But in 2000, we launched a project around this. And I want to acknowledge key people like Rayleigh, Kieran, Emma, Webber-Dredden up the back, myself, and some others who were involved in developing this. Joe Puka'iti, sadly no longer with us, but who was active with the Course Approval Board at that time. And we undertook our first approval, indeed at Rayleigh's program, University of Otago, There is a photo out on the board of a very young Shane Walker and a few other younger looking faces, us being greeted at Otago University. And then 2 years later, with Liz Beddow and colleagues at University of Auckland, and then at Unitech, where I now work. And we didn't move beyond that, and the registration sort of overtook things, etc. But it was a period of time when the association really broadened out and developed its own set of course approval standards, and undertook this program. It cost money, it wasn't that straightforward, but we partnered with academics and the profession. We had a bicultural expression on the board and on the visiting group, and off we went and undertook that. Kieran and myself and a few others promised to write this up sometime, don't we, Kieran? Yes, lest it get sort of forgotten in the mists of time. But it was another one of those little periods where the profession was really initiating and getting down the track on its involvement, that long strand of history around social work education and training.
And dealing with the politics of it, because there was the whole issue of the framework versus the non-framework
yes.
qualifications. That there was a New Zealand Qualifications Authority, which were framework programs, and then there were the others, which were under the Vice-Chancellor's Committee, the universities, and they were the non-framework, and the association got involved with the non-framework programs initially.
Yes.
And so as we head towards the end of that, this decade, of course, registration came in April 2013. The Act was passed. 2003. What did I say? 2013. Well, I'm going to the next decade already.
Good segue.
So that was something that the association had actually pushed for a long, long time. And the year before, or during that year, I think there was a workshop and some planning occurring around what was this association going to be in a post-regulatory environment. Because one of the hopes and expectations is that a large number of people would become registered. And so the association's, the cost to the association in terms of manpower and finances of actually having to deal with the number of complaints that we had, not that there was a large number, but they actually were very costly to resolve and time consuming to resolve. There was a hope that that would be handed off to the registration board. And of course, it was for those who were registered.
John, rewind that a bit? Because yep. I think if we go, we can follow through. There was a working party that was established by the association, which
that was the preparing for it.
Preparing for it, yeah. Because in 1994, I note that there was a remit to the 1994 AGM from Rayleigh and Lynn that there should be state certification based on competent practice. Now, that's not the first time that registration was addressed as an issue that membership was about. I mean, it goes back to 1964.
We were hearing about it right at the beginning.
But in terms of sort of what I think led to that point of making that remit was the fact that the competency program was up and running. Okay, we had a certificate. And I guess it was a matter of hopefully getting that certificate endorsed in some way
yes.
as the basis for registration. And that was in 1994, and it was out of that that, parallel to that, child, youth and family also were looking at their progress or lack of progress in respect of competency. And we worked towards 1998, 1999 to having a registration working party that then began to produce position papers from the association. And the I guess the report by Judge McBrown, which was around 2000, I think, as a consequence of that in 2001, the government committed $184 million to getting some registration on board. So, you know, there was the association there back in 1994, and then its own work that went on producing position papers, sharing those with members and getting a real kind of endorsement that there was a model of registration out there that the association was happy to go for.
How much money did they commit?
184.
$184 million.
Yeah.
Where did that go?
Yeah, that's me. Goodness gracious. Well, that was what they committed themselves to. Black and white.
Was that the professionalisation strategy within SIFS?
It came out of Judge McBrown's, so it would have been
right,
deal to the profession. It was for SIFS. Yes. But part of that was that there'd be a registration system in place. Didn't go to you, John.
I'm aware registration loomed very large, and we've talked about it the way through, and the next decade, of course, can really dive into that further, perhaps. I'm just wondering about a couple of other points that strike me about this decade. In terms of international involvement, I think we really hit quite a peak, as I was saying. I think our bicultural representation on the international stage was very strong. Alongside that, we had Buster Kirsten, Fiona Robertson getting onto the International Federation of Social Work executive and board during that time. And subsequently, others, of course, have become very involved. And also, in a parallel sense, the social work educators during this period in 96 established their own council, which is still going today, which I've got the pleasure of being involved with myself. And Gavin Rennie, who was the inaugural chair of that body, went on to become treasurer of the International Association of Schools of Social Work. Fascinating that we should have Fiona, treasurer of IF, and Gavin, treasurer of IA. It's like we'd become very powerful and had this global power at our fingertips. Which was quite something. And of course now we've got Rory Truerle as Director, Secretary General for IF. So punching well above our weight in the international stage and still very involved. We've currently got Mark Henriksen as the new Treasurer for the International Association of Schools, and New Zealand also has a seat on that council. So it's an exciting involvement. One other thing I'll mention, just to keep Mike O'Brien happy about where's the social justice and the public comment in all this, because I must admit, with all this growth and activity, as good as it was, and keeping the competency program going, that was very absorbing internally for the association. And I think, as someone who was involved during that time, it was always hard to try and keep our public questions, our social justice, outward-looking, mission alive. But I really took a lead from Buster Kirsten as the previous president to me, who was very active in making media comment. And I remember the satisfaction I got as a member, hearing either the president or someone from the association commenting in the media. So in 96, when I became president, my first job was to get a cell phone, which, had come into existence then. And
I didn't have one.
Well, that was later, yeah. And part of the idea was to be available for the media and get in those quick comments. So it was a pleasure to carry on that tradition and have a public voice for the association. And still today, sometimes Lucy, as our EO, is on the media and others, and it's great when that happens, I think. It's an important part of having our voice in the public sphere.
I just wanted to add to the international representation that existed during that time. I remember attending a conference, IFSW, I think, in Brisbane, and there were a number in the room that were presenting, and Harata had a presentation, and we all went up to Tautokohu with the waiata after her presentation, and as I was leaving the room, somebody made a comment, why do they do that? And somebody else responded, oh, that's the way New Zealand does it. So it was really nice to hear that even at that time, you know, people were more aware that we have a different way of working and it works for us.
Mm. Kia ora.
We've got about 5 minutes, so how would the panel like to use that?
Yeah. I just wanted to mention some invisible folk who've been part of the association for a long time who aren't necessarily members. People like Dinah Hyam, who has been the typesetter for the journal for the past 20 years, lives in Roxburgh, on a farm, on Knobley Range, and you know, produced the notice board for us. And obviously continues to do the typesetting for the journal.
I can't sing my praises enough.
And then as we moved into, you know, we engaged people too, and as we moved into the whole registration thing, making submissions, talking to the Ministry of Social Policy, people like Alistair Sheriff, you know, we paid good money for that, but it was pretty good advice. I remember I must have been asked to write to him to ask him to explain why his bill was like this. And he came back with a very fair, you know, account of what he had done. He'd done it a lot. But then said, you know, if you want to have a discussion about this, that's fine too. But people like that who I think stuck through and represented the association. And local suppliers and so forth. But there are a number of people that we, you know, are part of that background that you don't necessarily see and aren't at these sorts of things. National Office staff as well, currently.
Jean was going to be on the panel, and you've got some comments from Jean?
Oh, yes, Jean was, she came on as secretary. She said, but, you know, I couldn't do shorthand, I couldn't do nothing, you know, but Jean came on. And Jean, again, there's members in branches who are always there, who are supportive to setting up panels and so forth. You just give them the ring and they'll sort that out. And I think, you know, it's timely to think of those folk too. And you'll all know of them.
In those latter 1990 years, there was another person who was significantly supportive of the association, who has never been a member. However, he became minister, and Steve Mahari. And so from the middle of the 1990s, he was an advocate for the professionalisation of the profession as well as the development of registration. And it was due to his encouragement, his influence and his capability that we were able to achieve what we were. And at that time, in our naivety, we thought registration would just simply flow. And in fact, we had to show how much harm social workers can do in order for the legislation to be passed. And his support was particularly helpful in that.
Yes. Just
to add a bit to that, we mustn't forget Cullen, who actually gave money to the association.
Competency.
So you could write the competency standards. So yeah. Cullen was significant, and Lynn Brooks was very significant for getting that funding.
Yes.
I'll be sorry if this meeting passed without reference to Kelvin Menzies, who was secretary for a number of years. They were years when the association was much involved with its controversy with the government regarding the amalgamation of those two departments, which we're all familiar with. Now, I'm to Mary Nash, who's really truly our historian, and she has drawn attention to the fact that during that important period in the association's controversy, fight, whatever, there were some that stage, that should be well, and I think you used the word meticulously carried out. I'm so glad to read that, and I'm just sorry that I couldn't immediately somehow get in touch with Kelvin Benzies and pass that on. If anyone is in that position, I'm really quite that he should know that good work that he did for this association has been publicly acknowledged.
Thanks to the panel. We've hit our time. We've got a 5-minute stretch break, and then we're into the most recent decade from 2003 to 2014.